Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find out more about the organization and events online at commonwealthclub.org/InForum. Tonight we're here for the 2013 James Beard Awards, the Bay Area's big winners. We'll be tweeting the best of tonight's dialogue from InForum's handle, at InForumSF, and with tonight's hashtag, #SFJamesBeard. 2013 was a big year for Bay Area foodies, with several acclaimed local chefs, restaurants, and wine pros taking home the gold at the James Beard Awards, sometimes referred to as the Oscars of the food world. Tonight, we're here to celebrate the amazing crop of 2013 honorees and find out why the Bay Area is a great place to cook and eat, and what most excites each of them when it comes to food. Our panelists tonight include Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski, chefs and co-owners of State Bird Provisions, which won the 2013 James Beard Award for Best New Restaurant, Christopher Costo, executive chef at the restaurant at Meadowood and this year's James Beard Award winner for Best Chef West, and our moderator for this evening is Chef Michael Minna. As I'm sure you know, Michael is a legendary chef here in the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond. Since opening his first restaurant, Aqua, in 1991, he's gone on to build an influential culinary empire with more than 19 restaurants, including Bourbon Steak, Clock Bar, RN74, and Michael Minna right here in the city. Among his many honors, the James Beard Foundation awarded him the title of Best Chef in 2002, and this year he was inducted into James Beard's Who's Who in Food and Beverage in America. We're so excited to have him leading our discussion tonight. Please help me give a warm welcome to all of our panelists as I hand this evening over to Michael for our Q&A.
Thank you. We're going to answer the question right now, too. It really is just lemonade in these glasses, okay? I feel very privileged tonight to be here with three chefs that I respect tremendously. And actually enjoy very much spending time with. And I think that that's a big part of the Bay Area community of chefs is, you know, different than I think other cities and same as maybe some cities. I think that this is a city where I think chefs together have worked on so many different great causes and great projects. And part of, I think, why it's such an amazing food city is because I think that we're pretty down to earth here, and I don't think that anybody, the majority of the chefs here, you know, really kind of, I think, really get what the Bay Area is all about. Tonight, you know, we're going to hopefully talk about, you know, many different aspects of food and restaurants and everything else, but I think I wanted to kick it off really just by starting with, you know, what we're here talking about, which is the James Beard Awards. And for me, you know, I was fortunate enough to receive a couple of awards in the past and you know, have a little bit of time after receiving those to understand what it was all about. I remember the absolute deer in headlights at the beginning, the first time you go there and kind of has a little magnitude of how many people are there and everything else. And when you get up on stage and you really don't, you think you know what you're going to say, but the piece of paper shakes out of your hand, and so then you just have to kind of wing it, and then the reality of getting back to your restaurant, and now you have this award, and now you say to yourself, you know what, you know, how does, all the chefs up here, all three of you have won many awards, which are very different. I mean, Christopher has three Michelin stars, so, you know, I mean, bow to you. Something we'll chase all our lives. And so I just want to start with you, Christopher, to see if, you know, just kind of ask you about what it felt like and what's happened since then.
We had been nominated. Well, firstly, the exciting part is to sit in a theater with all these luminaries, people that you've looked up to, and see the name of your restaurant on the screen. And we're a very small restaurant in a smaller part of the world than, you know, to be at Lincoln Center and to see the restaurant in Meadow in whatever capacity. I mean, if my name's associated with her, or this year we're nominated for service as well, it's a pretty, for us, that's a pretty tremendous feeling. So having said, I was nominated for a couple of years and then won this year, and I agree with that assessment that you think you know you're going to go up there and be super articulate and you're going to wow them with your wisdom and your sagesse and you're going to floor the room, and you get up there and you have absolutely no idea what you're going to say. You know, your name gets called. I think I stood up and my phone went flying and I like kicked the person next to me and like stumbled out into the aisle. And everyone's looking at you, and then there's like the longest period of time imaginable where you walk down like this 3-mile-long ramp to go to a stage and walk 3 miles this way, and there's a lot of eyes on you, and it's an interesting feeling. In terms of winning and what that means, again, for the restaurant, it's a very positive thing in terms of business and in terms of awareness. But I don't think about it, frankly, that much. I'm sure you guys are the same. I mean, you get back, you celebrate that night, you have too much to drink, you wake up the next day, you fly home, and you go back to work. You know, and I think that's a fairly common trait in our industry.
Yeah. How about you, Nicole?
I just blacked out completely. I remember standing up, and then the rest is totally blackout. Thankfully, couldn't speak.
White lights.
Stuart did it. Oh, sorry.
It's just, I think it's so few things in life meet or exceed your expectations, especially nowadays when everything is sort of on the table in a way that I don't think it ever has been. And this, I have to say, completely, like, was as amazing and wonderful as you could imagine it would be. Mm-hmm.
I think the exciting part about the James Beard Awards is, I mean, as a cook, of course, you read about it and you're constantly, you know, watching chefs' careers change and evolve. And, you know, as a young cook, it is an aspiration and an inspiration to see. And also sort of there's a common thread, and there's kind of like a code that you start following, and as a cook, and you know, every year these awards come and go, and new winners, and it's really fascinating to kind of follow where chefs go beyond the award. And I think the moment, you know, what I really love about it is that it is your colleagues and peers, and many you don't even know. You know, I mean, the restaurant industry is, you know, 50 states in the U.S., and there's awards for 12 different regions, is it? I don't even know. Regions all across the country, and, you know, you read about these chefs, but you don't really have a relationship. And at some point, someone who has won an award is ticking your name off of a ballot
yeah.
sheet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at that point, you're kind of like, all right, you know, you restaurants get a lot of, especially when they open, you get a lot of press and good and bad, and, you know, it's all business, and, you know, and there's a lot of kind of isolated opinions, whether it's a restaurant reviewer or a magazine that's driven by, you know, 2 or 3, 4 people, you know, and there's, you never know really what the agenda is in that. But at the James Beard Awards, what is the agenda? And it's, you know, it's a ballot amongst people who really think about, you know, who's going to take my place in this. Mm-hmm. I'm sure when you, you know.
Right. Absolutely.
I look forward to seeing that ballot next year.
Right.
Really.
Right.
And absolutely. Really, like, you know, not just, you know, really taking a lot of careful thought and hopefully, you know, have the right, you know, accumulation of knowledge of these chefs that are candidates, you know.
Yeah.
To make the right decision. Or just a decision. So that's kind of a neat thing. It's your peers and it's your colleagues, and that's amazing, you know.
I remember, Christopher, when it was a little different, but it was California when I won that award, and what you say. So I went up and I had my speech and I was ready. Julia Childs gave me the award. She slapped me on the butt when I got up on stage, and I was just like, really? But it was surreal because it's, you know, it's like Julia Childs just gave you an award, and, you know, I mean, it's, you know, and it is, you know, pretty impactful. I think that the format of you get all of these chefs in one room in one night, and that's it. That's the only time you're ever going to get.
But
them
not
all
just
one
night.
Room.
It's all weekend.
It's that's all the weekend. Yeah, well,
it's like
yeah,
3 days
true.
Before you get to hang out with everyone.
Yeah, that's
and you
right.
Form these quick relationships that are long-lasting.
And yeah. As an event, there's nothing that's a bigger departure from what we do on an everyday basis than
absolutely.
Dressing us up in tuxedos and putting us in a room and then making us speak in public. I mean,
like, whenever they ask you to cook at it, do it, because then you don't have to wear the tuxedo.
Exactly. And the one constant is all the F-bombs that get dropped when people give their speeches, because that's just frankly how we tend to communicate with each other.
Sure.
So it's not an exercise in public speaking by any stretch of the imagination.
Or restraint.
Or restraint.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely. I think it is interesting, you know, in what after, like, what you were saying, sir, about, you know, who's going to win the award next year? Who's going to, you know, how does it change? Because it kind of is interesting, because it is, to me, kind of like what's great to see it is how this industry now view and how this community and how the world views restaurants now. You've got, you know, Christopher, whose restaurant is, you know, 3 Michelin stars, but is, you know, you're going to go in there and every, you know, besides every, I was fortunate enough to get to cook up there for the 12 days of Christmas, and, you know, going in there, and I'll never forget, like, you go into other chefs' kitchens and do events, and of course you're always, you know, you want to do your best work, but you also go in there, and when you walk out, you say, okay, what did, you know, besides the food, like, what else did you pick up? And I know everybody says this to you, but you go into your kitchen, and you had the pads down on the whole pass, and it was the most impressive pass that I've seen, you know, where all the plates go and everything else, and that level, like, of a restaurant. And then Stuart Nicole, who I know you've worked, I know where your background is, and when you left and you built your own restaurant, and the accolades that you've gotten with this restaurant, very well deserved. I ate there as well. Very well deserved. But, you know, a completely different spectrum from what Chris does. Not foreign to you what Chris does, obviously. I think that all this, but I think it's really interesting that the United States of America, the culinary world of America, best new restaurant in the United States, was your restaurant. And I think it's great because there's so much, it shows, to me, what it showed is the creativity that went behind not just the food, the conceptualization of the restaurant was actually rewarded. Mm-hmm. And I think in this day and age, it's, you know, it's very simple to always revert back to simplicity and say this or this, but to go out on a limb and say, okay, I want to do something that's completely out of the box, you know, and I think we all want to do it, but it takes the real thing to go out and do it, you know, and to see it be rewarded the way that it was rewarded for you, and knowing that the long-winded way to get to this question is that was that. So I've got two questions for you, Stuart, and then I have one for Nicole about it. Is that was that creativity? So, one, you know, what's next? And two, let me start with one. for you, what's next? Because I know that you might be working on a project or.
Well, just to revert back real quick, the James Beard, I think, you know, it is really interesting, the state of restaurants and the evolution. And, you know, there was, you know, sort of, you know, a few years ago, especially after like 08, everything kind of reverted to, I want really comfort food and, you know, burgers and pizzas and, you know, which is, you know, an amazing thing to eat, of course, but it became, you know, there was, you know, it was a scary time. I mean, both just financially and then, you know, from a restaurant. And there's a point that, like, you know, I think you got to come above that. But what we really took from that was, you know, a sense of value and kind of creativity at a value. And so it didn't seem like such a risk to do something so out of the box, you know. Right. It seemed more natural because I think that the time was right. We were ready, you know. Honestly, it was 3.5 years between when Rubicon closed and State Bird, so I think that we went into it completely naively. So that helped, actually, kind of give us a... We just, like, kind of forgot what it really meant to have a certain style of a restaurant. And mm-hmm. we're so driven by, let's just kind of do whatever we want to do. And so what's next is that well, we're doing SBP 2.0 next month, and probably many of you know that we're closing our restaurant for a remodel as well as a slight expansion, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing where that takes us. You know, we were very cautious about how big we wanted it to get because I think we've got something incredibly special and don't want to lose that feeling. And so we really thought about a lot of the details, more than what we did when we opened, that's for sure. So I think that's the big part, the big one. And that kind of happened... fortunately, it happened, but kind of all along we were planning this other restaurant right next door. It's always been my dream. I think it was maybe when I was 23, I worked in France, and I worked for Michel Rostang, and I remember bouncing back and forth from the gastro to the bistro, and the restaurants were right on, you know, a corner, gastro on one side, bistro here. And you'd be in one kitchen. It was this amazing thing that you could be like, you know, the meat slicer existed in the bistro and the gastro had, you know, all the truffles. And, you know, I mean, that's kind of how it worked, actually. But it was just this really, like, two faces of cooking from one chef's idea. And I loved that. And I always thought to myself, wouldn't it be great to have kind of a, you know, two restaurants side by side that could have those shared elements, and you have the sharing of ideas. And so coming up, we've been working on The Progress, which is in the same building, and, you know, symbiotic. There will be some similarities to the restaurants. There will be symbiosis to the two restaurants. However, they will be distinctively different as well, which I think is important. We don't want to repeat ourselves next door.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to that one really coming together as well. And what I love is that within like 30 seconds, I can be in either restaurant or Nicole as well and, you know, our staff and... So I feel like that it'll be just a neat way to really run two operations under one roof.
That's great.
Yeah.
Nicole, when you're conceptualizing dishes mm-hmm. in this format, and I'm sure you get asked this a lot, I'm asking it from a different point of view because, you know, I did a restaurant in L.A. with all little dishes mm-hmm. and didn't go so well. loved it. I thought it was probably the best work that we had done as a group. Loved it. Just thought it was phenomenal. But couldn't get people to understand it. Mm-hmm. Really just couldn't.
Which restaurant was this?
14. Could not get people to understand it. I really thought it was what we had probably at that point. I thought it was, you know, really one of the best restaurants we'd ever done and I had ever been involved in. And when I ate at State Bird, I kind of slammed my fist on the table and said, they got it. they figured out how to do it.
We learned from that.
No. but conceptualizing food for that was completely different.
Totally.
Completely different. Yep. Because it wasn't just, you know, tasting portions. It was mm-hmm. completely different thought process. And I know that, you know, in pastry, especially with all the different, you know, aspects of pastry, how do you conceptualize.
Well, he's a hard act to follow to begin with, so I have to take that into consideration. But when we conceptualize dishes, we think a lot about sharing and the fact that everyone at the table, most likely 95% of the time, will be sharing the dish, so it has to be easy to share. You have to put it together in a way that is also easy to deconstruct onto four plates where each person can get the same experience as if they had just the one dish in front of them. Mm-hmm. So that changes the way that you put it together and think about flavors. But it's still our food. So it's as if you took a dish from Rubicon, and I remember I would do these plated desserts where there was a shot of peanut milk and a chocolate mousse that was glazed in butterscotch caramel, you know, 17 different things happening, and you can't share that. You know, you don't want to pass the cup around and share it. So now we do a $2 peanut milk shot. So you kind of take that one dish apart and let people put it back together if they so choose.
Yeah, like a scoop of ice cream doesn't work, right. You know, but an ice cream sandwich cut into four different pieces does, you know. You know, The menu is always, it's constructed into twos and fours. Like, that's it. We have four tops and two tops. And so everything comes out, can either be for two or four people, depending on the dish.
That's great.
Yeah.
Christopher, I got a question for you.
Oh boy.
So, obviously, in that environment, Not by any way leading you to what is something else that you're gonna do or anything else, but
thank God.
but like, you know, because I kind of always now, because I've had to, you know, build other restaurants outside of that realm. Like, what would, in your mind, what would be, you know, a really fun restaurant to be involved in, a type of cuisine, if you could, you know, another type of cuisine, another type of restaurant? Or,
I mean, there's a couple things at work that we want to do that are fairly specific. I think the important thing is that it, and I think you guys spoke to this idea that the food you do at Staper is different than the food you do at Rubicon, but it's the same DNA. And I think whatever it is that I do next, it has to feel in some way familiar to what we're doing at the restaurant. Right. And the thing is, what we do at the restaurant, everything is so fluid, and it's all written in pencil, we say. Like, if it's contingent as much as it is on what's coming out of the ground, the garden, or what's being foraged for us, or so on and so forth, it's the least scalable thing in the world. I mean, you can't do another one, you can't repeat it. And I think some of those operating principles, I don't know how applicable they are to a large, more casual venue, you know?
Right.
But I think that, again, those operating principles, those idea of sort of craftsmanship and artisanship and the sense of place, and ideally some degree of intellect in the food, some degree of humor in the food, a huge emphasis on hospitality and an understanding of the guest. I think, again, those things I think are transferable. So I guess the short answer is that DNA, that idea can manifest itself in a lot of ways, and we're going to kind of see what way that's going to be.
Okay. One more question then.
Yeah.
So, take away your style of cooking and what you cook. What influence, or what would you have fun with? Like, for me, it's Japanese.
Right.
Like, yeah, I always have fun with that.
Right.
You know, outside of we cook on a normal basis. Like, and I'm not saying you're building this restaurant or anything
right.
like that. But you know, what kind of cuisine
I think most of my again, we all are. Irrespective of how cognizant we are, but I think we are invariably driven by our food memories, because that's what else do we really have to draw from?
Sure.
So I think that there's a certain sort of flavor palette that speaks to me, which is very sort of Eastern European in nature. And you see that a lot in what we do in the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a lot of smoke or a lot of pickle or a lot of sort of the use of lactic elements or sort of not cheaper, but different cuts of meat used, you know, kind of treated in a more elegant fashion, things like that. Resonate a lot with me, so I think that as a source of inspiration, like Eastern European food, I think has a lot of value to me. And when I sort of began my own education with food, it was all very French based. I spent, you know, several years working in France, and those were some of the real primary food experiences that I think that still resonate with me a lot. You know, if it's that, and if it's a Blanc de Veau, or if it's whatever, a good, you know, Pate de Campagne or whatever, those things to me are have like such a tremendous amount of value. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of the techniques employed, in terms of the history that it speaks to, in terms of just how like straight up delicious it is, that to me is pretty exceptional as well.
How do you eat your eggs?
How do I eat my eggs? How do I eat my eggs? What's the answer? Oh, yeah, scrambled over, right. Or an egg patty over rice is a rule. Yeah.
Nicole?
Oh, really, like, oozing egg yolk. That's, like, it doesn't matter what else is there. The egg yolk just has to be bright orange and oozy.
Stuart?
I love just throwing like an egg right into whatever dish I am and just like
I was gonna say there's a style of egg cookery that is only used by cooks and that is like you don't like crack your eggs in a bowl and you drop your eggs into the pan and scramble them while they cook and they'll be done like super quick. I think that's like that's not a technique that's employed by anybody other than chefs. I
think. What about you?
Well, soft scrambled. Soft scrambled.
Copper pot?
Over bain. Copper whiz, copper pot. Yeah.
And my little 12-year-old makes them for me. He's got it mastered. Every morning, he's got it mastered.
Nice. This is a 12-year-old you have employed at the house, or this is...
Yes. So, Christopher, one more question, and it might just be because of jealousy, but 3 Michelin stars, and I know you get it all the time, but I mean, honestly, I mean, it's, you know, it's remarkable. I know that probably all of us are the same. You get awards and you don't know exactly, you know you go in every day, you know you work your butt off, and you know that, you know, it's like, I think everybody's going to answer things always the same way. It's like, oh, you know, it's great people around me and everything else. But honestly, a lot of us have great people around us, and that's serious. I mean, that's a...
You know, there's no objective reality to any of these awards. If it's James Beard, if it's Michelin, if it's Pellegrino, you know, who knows? But someone said, like, that your reputation is what other people think you are, your character is what you really are. And I think when it comes to restaurants, I think that when those two things are the same, then you can be great. Meaning, if you're really practicing in terms of the product you employ, in terms of how you deal with your people, in terms of, like, attention to detail, if you're really... at the same level as what other people perceive you to be and you are every day, then maybe you're deserving of those accolades. But, you know, I don't know if one day we were 2 stars, one day we were 3 stars, if there was some, I don't know. I'd like to think that it was had to do with consistency and maybe something unique in what we were doing in terms of our voice. I can't say we deserve it or someone else does. I really don't think about it, to be perfectly honest with you. I think, you know, it was an award we got many years ago. I hope to think that we're better, infinitely better than we were at the time. And our objective and our direction far supersedes, you know, what someone else is going to say of us, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree. I mean, I think the thing that, you know, is kind of cliche, but we've said it forever and I have never doubted it, is a restaurant every day, no matter what, come hell or high water, will be better or worse than it was the day before.
Absolutely.
You've got human nature involved, and our jobs, any of us, is how do you make better each day, right? Mm-hmm. Sounds cliche, but it's true.
Yeah.
It's like you go in, I guarantee you, you go in your restaurant tonight, you get 3 Michelin stars, doesn't matter, best new restaurant in the United States, doesn't matter. You walk in today, and it's either better or worse than it was yesterday.
I tell my cooks all the time, I'm scared. I run up the stairs every morning to work. And it's a little bit of fear, and it's a little bit of excitement. And the second you lose that, then you're getting worse.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt. I know, Stuart, we were talking back there, and you're like, you know, you still get the butterflies every day before service, you know, when you're going into service in your stomach. And it's funny because my life's a little different now. I try to, like, you know, I'll spend a month, you know, or so. I got to be real honest because Gary, my corporate chef's right there. So, you know, running the kitchen when I go, when I open a restaurant or whatever. And the reason I do it is so that when I go there for a day, I feel comfortable walking in and doing it. I don't feel, you know, I'm not, but I'll tell you, it's enormously nerve-wracking. I mean, literally, if you haven't been in, you know, we opened Strip Steak in Las Vegas, and you know, when I after we opened it and I left, I never forget going back to the first day, and it's like, it's a restaurant that does like 350 covers, and all of a sudden all these tickets are on the board. You watch everybody cooking, you know, it's the type of thing where at the end of the day you're just like, yes. And you were saying, Stuart, before about how it is like, it is that nerve-wracking before service still, and you think it's, oh well, we do this every day. People will come in and they're like, oh, it's old hat, you do it every day, but it's not, right? There's just a million moving pieces.
No, yeah. Yeah, there's every day that door opens and there's a line of people trying to get in, and that makes me nervous, and you know, it's very proud as well. I mean, certainly, and I look at my cooks and you know, I'll lean over and I'll say, God, you know, my stomach's in knots right now. And, you know, she'll say, mine is too, chef, you know, or, you know, and I'm like, well, I guess that, you know, and I think that, like, when you want to be good and you are, you try to be the best that you can every day, that those feelings never go away, you know. And I remember as a young cook, you know, just trying to get set up for service and going into it and, you know, maybe not getting yelled at by the chef, or, you know, you especially after 2 days off, you come in and you're like, all right, so nervous, you know, you're just nervous, and that's just kind of a cook's life. And I think it's that sense of wanting to please. I think it's, you know, you're putting, you know, kind of a creative force out on the line, right? And, you know, it's totally subjective, for sure, right? Everyone tastes completely different. Everyone has relationships to food that are different than yours. And, you know, as a chef, over years of experience, I think you start deciphering, you know, kind of, your cooking evolves with, you know, the people that you cook for. Mm-hmm. But even then, every day you could be looking at the same dishes that you cooked the night before, and you'd be like, just doesn't feel good today, you know? Yeah, and yet, whenever I feel that way, it's generally the opposite in the dining room. I know that, which is kind of a weird place to be. I don't know if you guys have this, yeah, but absolutely. We tend to get these, you know, folks coming back through the dining room. They're just like, this is so great. This is an amazing meal. And you're just like, oh, God, really?
I think it's that consistent ADD between all of us.
It is. I mean, one day you just look at a dish that you literally love the day before, and you're like, this sucks.
I don't want to ever see this dish again.
Yeah. It sucks.
Yeah. Poor guy on that station, too. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
I don't understand. I did the same way yesterday.
Yeah. What am I doing with myself? Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you're right. It's, Stuart, Nicole, you're going from, you know, one to two, but you're doing it next door to each other, right? And, you know, and I remember that process for me. You know, I was really fortunate, and I think Christopher, kind of like you know, you were a chef at a really young age, like, you know, and it's that, the question mark always, oh, did I take my first chef job too early? Did, you know, I think all three of us are actually, all of us are sitting here in the same boat where Definitely. you're gonna question yourself about that. For me, I mean, you can question yourself about it for life, right? It doesn't matter. I have 18 restaurants. I still question myself about it all the time. I was Chef Avaco. I was 23 years old. I didn't expect it to be as successful as it was, but, it was. And so then you get that great thing of like getting to learn from all the people that worked from you, you know, work for you or work with you or whatever it is, and getting, you know, that ability to surround yourself with talent. But it still is that huge decision at that early stage for all of you guys, right? Is am I the person that's going to go from one to more, mm-hmm. or not? And I remember doing it early on, and I think that back then it was really more frowned upon with chefs, and it really bothered me. It really bothered me that it was frowned upon for chefs in the media to have more than one restaurant, but yet quote unquote restaurateurs who were usually, you know, lawyers who had taken advantage of chefs or something, you know, like that. It was okay for restaurateurs, quote unquote, to have more than one restaurant. But once a chef did it, it was like, oh, well, they're not in their kitchen or that. And to me, there was, for me, I waited 9 years with Aqua and built a great group of people around me. So I felt really confident when I did it that I had the talent. They had stayed at the restaurant. They all needed to grow. It's really hard because I'm sure all of us are, you're always in the same boat where you got talent around you. The talent, you know, there's only so much at one restaurant you can do for them. But yet, when you make that decision to go to more than one, even if it's next door, it changes your life. Sure. You know, it's that second child, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's always tougher than the first one, right? So, Stuart, you're about to do it. Is there nervous energy? Is it something you, you know?
Yeah, it is. I think, Michael, you were really kind of on the pioneering stage of that, of chefs who are growing and maintaining really incredible integrity to the food and to the concept, and really and turning and churning out great talent. I mean, I've had the pleasure of working with a lot of talent that have come through your restaurants, not necessarily under your direction. And it's kind of, you know, you weigh that out, and I think that says a lot, you know. I think that what, you know, that 9 years of culture creating, mm-hmm. you know, creating what it is that you are about and your restaurant is about, you know, and you take that to your next restaurants, and it's got that kind of guideline of culture, and it's really evident, you know.
Thank you.
And really, it's really impressive. And I think that there's a lot of questions that surround that about growth and restaurateurs. I mean, we have a 50-seat restaurant. You know, we serve 170 people a night. We have a lot of fun doing it, you know. But I'm not ready for that to be the end or the all is. I feel like that there's a lot I want to do creatively, and there's a lot of talent that, you know, we're developing our culture, and you know, and that's, you know, 10 years of being an executive chef, I've developed those philosophies and techniques, and, you know, I'm looking forward to that growth. Albeit it scares me to do what you do, where you have to get on a plane and go, you know, other places. But then again, I'm also like, it's pretty amazing that you can, you know, you show that it's very possible and very real. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to go next door, and I feel really comfortable with that because it's the same faces I'm seeing every day who are maybe splitting up tasks or, you know, and we're creating that. Ultimately, there's going to be a culture of the building now, of the progress
right.
of State Bird.
Right.
And, you know, I feel like it's exactly where I want to be in my career. It's where, you know, I mean, Nicole and I both want to be. We're ready to kind of take this and grow and create different outlets. I also think that our society demands it, to be honest.
Yeah,
I think that's a big part.
Yeah.
In San Francisco, it's like, are we celebrating a restaurant that's 25 years old, or are we celebrating a restaurant that's 6 months old? And we're
right.
constantly looking, hey, where's the new place you've been eating? Where's this? And, you know, it's like we're not even 2 years old, and sometimes I feel like we're old. People are like, right. You know, oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, State Fair Java. Like, really?
Right. That is very applicable. For
you know, and so I think that it's our culture as a society, you know, and,
yeah.
You know, that, you know, yeah. That's part of what's, you know, we see it everywhere in so many different industries, I suppose. Yeah. You know, and I don't know, when you become that person and you know you become a big picture and it's that talent that you create. What's right. next? You know, do they right. want to leave? I mean, they may not want to, and yeah. you know, it's not our responsibility to create more mm-hmm. opportunity for the talent. I mean, it's you know, seems perfectly fine and sensible that somebody sort of approaching 5 years and they're ready to go out on their own that they should, you know. Yeah. But yeah. maybe they're not ready to go out on their own, and yeah.
and there's less and less of those cooks. I remember talking to you many, many years ago, where you explained that sort of rationale of, you know, opening other restaurants to provide opportunities for all the people we had. I think there's been like a seismic shift now, and there's an article in the New York Times about the other day that, you know, restaurants in New York can't find cooks, which just seems counterintuitive with all the food TV and all these people going to culinary school. Mm-hmm. But there aren't as many people putting in those 5 years that there were, in my experience, that there were five years ago. So right. the impetus for opening other places is that idea of A, staying current or being seen as current. But it's also, there's a value, justified or not, placed on the idea of entrepreneurship. And it is seen as demonstrating success that you have more than one place. Because what it shows is people must really like you if you need to open more than one place. So if you've only opened one place, does that mean, you know, does that speak to your inherent value? And I think that's a distinctly American idea. Mm-hmm. And the lines have now become blurred that maybe it was frowned upon when you did it, but now I think to the contrary, it's almost necessary now to kind of be seen in a certain light. I mean, there's very few chefs that are household, not even household names, but that are well considered in any capacity that only have one restaurant.
So we're about 5 minutes away from questions, okay? So get yours ready. I'm going to give away this microphone in 5 minutes. This is not my forte, trust me. But, Chris, I completely agree with what you were saying. And I think that, you know, I saw when I was in your kitchen where you had enormous, you know, you had surrounded yourself by real talent, but you could tell that they, you know, they were trained, and I think it's one thing about starting when you're young, the difference of, you know, waiting till you're 35 or 40 to take your first chef job. If you do it when you're young, you know, a lot of times that energy, and you end up with four or five or six people around you that have that, you know, you're the same. Yeah, you know, I remember, you know, going to the same bars with them, doing the same things, and you're always talking about the same thing. You're always talking about food. You're always and I think that for me, I mean, that's, you know, knock on wood, I feel like that's what made us successful, was that it was this really tight-knit group of people. Even if they left, whether it was Ron Siegel, whether it was Chris Lahamidou, they go work for great chefs. And if you get a chance to cross paths again, that's when it's even more powerful. That, to me, was like, is, you know, really, really powerful, where they've worked for you, they go out work for, you know, great chefs like yourselves, and then you get a chance to work with them again in a different capacity. It's like, you know, be it Chris Lahamidou, be it Ron Siegel, you know, you walk into there, and that's so enjoyable, because you know the kitchen's being ran,
right.
You know, right. to a very high level, and that was really rewarding for me. Like, that, to me, it's like, you know, when you're learning from people around you that work for you, and like you said, it doesn't matter. It's like, there's no way you're going to direct 18 kitchens, but you hope that out of those 18 kitchens, or out of one kitchen, the people go on to do something, right? You know, like Josh Skanes came and worked with us, you know, and really talented guy, but I felt like he finally kind of learned how to actually run, you know, get a business, and I see him now, and he's extraordinarily successful. I hope we had something to do with it. Am I going to say that I taught the guy how to cook? Not a chance, right? But there's, you know, I think that there's different ways, and I think that's why you see our city and our country is, you know, and I think that's where my first comment came from, that I felt that it wasn't fair that chefs weren't the driving force of building restaurants, because I feel that they have a lot to offer. You know, there is some great restaurateurs, of course, by the way, but I think that chefs, you know, like yourselves, you know, as you do more restaurants, have a lot to, people are going to buy into it. The cooks, people buy into it more. The people around you buy into it. And if they go on to open a small restaurant, a big restaurant, whatever it is, hopefully it's just more great food, you know.
Well, I think that, you know, opening a restaurant as a chef, it's a restaurant. I mean, it's still a restaurant. Right. It's everything that's under that roof is what we think about, you know, not just, you know, the kitchen, you know. When I was hired as a chef, it was like really I was like a chef, mm-hmm. right? I felt like that was most when I was
card.
In my kitchen. What's that?
Yeah, you got the card.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, yeah, I got a card. And yeah, it said chef, and so that's what I became. And, but, you know, there was an owner or restaurateur. You know, there was somebody who kind of ran the business, and, you know, it's a different world now. And I constantly... Yeah, I remind myself that, you know, I'm not only a chef anymore. I'm, you know, I am a restaurant owner, and that means that ultimately, I mean, we extend that culture of the kitchen to the front of the house, and that's kind of how we chose to do it for State mm-hmm. Bird. And then sort of it is reinforced by the front of the house back to the kitchen. It's a really neat thing, but, you know, at the end of the day, if you want to be a chef owner of a restaurant, you are still a restaurant owner, right. no matter what. And everything oh, yeah. that is in there, it's no longer like this is the line here, you know, don't cross here. You know, dining room, front of the house, back of the house, it's all the same. Dishwasher, bathroom.
All right. I think we're ready for questions. As a reminder to our radio audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club. For more about the info,
this is not, like I said, this is not my forte. Okay, we're going to questions now. All right. Okay.
Hi. I know that Nicole and Stuart, you're participating in the October 4th James Beard Foundation Taste America event. Here in San Francisco, and that it's going to be a celebration of James Beard, and I just wanted to know what that meant to you and what you guys are bringing to your dish at the event.
I don't think we've decided.
Yeah.
I don't think we've got the menu written.
Celebration of James Beard. How are you planning to exude that? I know that's kind of a challenge in terms of an inspiration.
I'll give you one. Okay. I'll give you a fun one. His birthday and my birthday are the same day. It's on Cinco de Mayo.
All right.
Yeah. Do something inspired.
Yeah.
Or really, like, what the legacy of James Beard, like, that's kind of a beast to attempt to represent in a dish or even in an event, and how you guys plan to do that.
Let's see here. It's interesting to think of James Beard as a person. Because it's elevated to a foundation, and the foundation is so enormous, and like, you know, that it is really interesting. I actually just think about this, like, he's got a cookery, it's a fire cookery book. I whenever I think of, like, reminded that James Beard is actually a person, and that he was an author and a culinarian, and I think of James Beard, this James Beard fiery cookbook, fire cookbook. Has anybody seen this? No? All right. Check with Celia at Omnivore. She's probably got it. But I've got a whole slew of his cookbooks, fish cookery, right?
You're
and then these
bread.
Like funny, like no pictures, funny drawings, like little two sticks in the fire, right? And he talks about cooking over the fire. Not that this is anything relevant, but whenever I think Because it's not. Whenever I think about James Beard Foundation, I don't think of the man James Beard. But when I think of the man James Beard, I think of this really kind of silly cookbook he wrote in the 60s, you know, or 70s of fire cookery, which is really campfire. It's like s'mores.
How do you take the James Beard Foundation or the idea of these awards that he's built and bring it back down to earth as a person? So that's a fire.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Campfire.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi, my name is Tim, and I have a question for the panel. Some of the dishes you guys create are some of the most innovative and delicious in the world. So with the popularity of guides like the Flavor Bible, what advice do you have for home chefs to look beyond just your standard recipes or stuff you get off the internet to actually cook something new and interesting?
Well, I think using a chef's pinch of salt, not a home cook's pinch of salt, and butter. Those are the two things. Nobody at home cooks with enough salt or butter across the board.
Yeah, that was a laugh giggle to you. Yeah.
I would just say that less of a focus on recipes and more of a focus on the techniques, because techniques yield good tasting food. A recipe without a knowledge of how to do things or what the good products are or how to have a sharp knife or what good salt is, blah, blah, blah. Without those things, you're not going to do good food. So I think the emphasis is too much on like how to make enchiladas, whereas the emphasis should be on how to make a tortilla, how to make that sauce, and kind of that. Those are the foundations for good cooking, not these recipes that are everywhere.
And taste. Actually, taste. Yeah. You'll go to people's house and you watch them cook. They're cooking. Mm-hmm. They're never tasting. They're panicked, and they're not actually tasting. Mm-hmm. You got to taste.
A question for Michael. There is a show on the Food Network called The Best Thing I Ever Ate, and I wanted to ask you, what is the best thing you've ever ate, not including your own food?
That egg in the morning.
That egg in the morning. Anthony's egg in the morning.
Served from the hands of a 12-year-old.
Probably... You know, I would say it's actually it's a Bay Area product. I actually, the first time I had abalone, and it was a real clean, simple dish. It was actually with egg. It was just egg battered and great brown butter, and I'd never had it, and it was just done perfectly. It was, you know, that was probably the best thing I ever ate.
Good evening, panel. Thank you for the great discussion. My question is in the Bay Area, as a chef, do you feel like your vision is compromised, or do you feel challenged when people come to your restaurants with all sorts of diets, gluten-free,
Chris,
veganism,
this is yours.
Vegetarianism, Paleolithic? It's bizarre.
I think it's funny, because last night at service we had, 20 tables, 25 tables, and every single table had some allergy. But if you can devise the systems, like for us, we have extensive conversation with all of our guests before they get there, so we know what's coming. So we have a system in place wherein I write the menu for that evening, like the normal menu, the pescatarian menu, the no-gluten menu, the vegetarian menu. If you're outside those, all the parameters that we create, then we're in serious trouble. So it's not a challenge for us, because we haven't given ourselves the time to make sure that we're not looking at it as a problem, and we're looking at it as kind of an opportunity, and we've given it enough thought. Because what oftentimes happens is if you come in with a slew of allergies, things are being thrown together for you, and we kind of didn't want that to be the case. So I don't look at it as a challenge per se, other than in the midst of service, it just throws in challenges.
Does it compromise your vision at all, do you feel like? Or...
Well, if part of your vision is providing hospitality, then no.
Okay.
Chef Christopher, I guess this question is for everybody, but your journey from philosophy in Illinois to France to San Francisco, how much was that planned out, and how much of it just kind of happened?
I read somewhere recently that when you're living your life, it's always chaotic, and you're just grasping at random things. But when you look back, it looks like a perfectly wrought novel, you know. So in retrospect, it was all perfectly planned. But, you know, if you're ambitious, and I think everyone up here is ambitious, you're always looking for what's going to give you a little more education, make you a little bit better, provide a little bit better of an opportunity. The problem is when you're 20, you haven't the slightest idea what those things actually are. You think you do. And when you talk, I'm sure when you talk to young cooks now, and they either when they're coming or going or they have an issue, you realize their rationale is really not great. So I'm sure I was even worse. To your question, I always thought I was acting in a way that was going to get me to where I am now, but I don't know if those decisions necessarily brought me to where I am now.
Yeah, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about menu design and the relationship between the price point of the restaurant and how those kind of two work and how you design the menu, just in relationship of how you've established the restaurant and the pricing there.
Yeah, I'd love to take this. it's funny, you know, all of our restaurants are so significantly different, and I think that, you know, the menu design has to be in balance with your total offerings, right? I feel like, you know, we have no white tablecloths, we have no soundproofing, we have loud music, we have really good food, and it comes out in small plates. Our pricing is relevant to the restaurant that we are, right? And you know our philosophy there has always been to cast a wide wide net, catch a lot of fish, right? And by doing that is that you make it accessible. So that's been our I think every restaurant is founded upon, like, kind of what you're pricing on. That's gonna instruct what kind of chairs are in your dining room and what kind of plateware you're cooking, you're plating on. You know, everything comes down to your pricing. And and then of course there's certain rules that apply. You know, there's food cost percentages that are proven numbers that make your business stay in business. I think that, you know, you become a very, your accountant becomes a good friend to your business, informs you as a chef, and, you know, has a way of sort of, you know, you weave together, you weave in and out. I don't know if that answered your question. Roundabout way? Yeah. Yeah.
Since this is an award ceremony, congratulations, definitely outstanding accomplishments. So my question has to do with awards and accolades. As chefs and professionals, you've alluded to this a little bit in your conversations, do the awards free you up to be more innovative, or do you feel it's at all restrictive, like you have to meet certain standards or perform within certain boundaries? Which direction, or no change at all in your attitude?
I think that they free you up in the sense that, you know, they help you with the things that will help you to get your restaurant to the next level, which is better staff, clientele, more consistent business. And so I think that, you know, they can be a positive or a negative based on how you conduct yourself in the restaurant after the awards. You know, if you keep them in a, you know, it's like Chris's personality of when we were talking about his three Michelin stars, you know, just using it as a tool to just get you the things you need to improve your restaurant, then your awards help you. If you let it, you know, manifest into your staff and put yourself on a pedestal and forget the fact that it's all about, you know, how do you connect with your guests better, then they don't help you.
Mm-hmm. Other than home, what are your favorite places to eat on a night off?
Stewart's.
Let's see.
Meadowood? Michael Mina? Yeah, yeah.
You get
get asked this question often.
This is a very common question. It depends on the day, really. Sometimes I like to go where, you know, I can just eat in peace, or other times I like to go to, you know, restaurants where my friends are cooking and my friends are running it. And, you know, oftentimes in our business, it's the only time that you get to see your friends, because it's not like, you know, hey, what are you doing this weekend? Let's get together on Saturday. Yeah. So, you know, we don't really get to do this here.
Okay.
So, you know.
I'm going to relieve you.
Thank you. Yes.
So I get to ask a magical question. This is yours next year, Chris. You get to have the cards. 60-second question for you. Okay? 60-second answer. Change the world and with a 60-second idea, what would it be? Christopher.
Can I throw this to the audience? God, I really should have thought of this. The question is, what a 60-second idea that could change the world?
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit. I would have hoped that someone would have thought of it already. But, I guess probably more discourse. I make the mistake of reading the newspaper and listening to news on the radio, and well, obviously it's so I don't want to even say partisan, but it's people have stopped talking and listening, and everyone's just yelling what they believe to be right, and there's this overemphasis on consistency, and really every issue that faces us as chefs or as people, as citizens, are exceptionally complicated and require actually thought and a lot of analysis and study and communication. And but instead what we all do is we pick our sides and we yell really loud, and that's a real challenge, I think, for a democracy, for a society, and as people. So I guess I would just say more conversation.
Nicole?
Living, working, and playing with equal parts passion and humor.
Stuart?
5 seconds. Small steps and big smiles, I think.
Okay. I guess we're going to end with mine, and then we're free. adopt something or someone. You know, adopt something or adopt someone, whether it's a puppy, whether it's a stray dog or a stray cat. I just got a puppy, by the way. whether it's, you know, somebody that you can just make a small token to, it's a good feeling. Makes you feel good. That's it. Thank you very much.